Oh, what a great day. Glad you guys are here. May God bless you. You know, after Jesus was born, his dad decided to keep the family in Bethlehem. And they got to Bethlehem because it was a time for the census so that the Roman government could make sure they got taxes from everybody. So you'd have to go to your ancestral home and the home of your birth. So Joseph most likely decided, I may as well stay in Bethlehem. I know people here. There's probably family of his here. It's a good place to start our business. Bethlehem was a lot quieter area. It was agrarian all around it. Many pastures for sheep. And it was quite the contrast of their original city where they lived in, which was Nazareth, which was a main city and a main thoroughfare from Damascus, Syria to the Mediterranean Sea, and many goods would pass through that. And it had all the vices of a city that was kind of a port city, you know. So it was a mini Las Vegas. So to be in Bethlehem was a great change from what they were used to, and it was calmer. And so Joseph and Mary obviously decided to stay there and to begin to build their life together. You know, how many of us have seen the stable scenes of the manger and the little barn with the star on top, and you got the shepherds there, and you got Mary and Joseph, you got a couple animals. Anybody ever see that kind of stuff? Well, we had that too, and then you had the wise men there, and it's a beautiful scene, but it's kind of not biblically accurate because the wise men didn't come for a number of years. Somewhere between the ages of 15 months to 2 years is when the wise men actually visited. And, you know, we grew up Catholic, so not only would you have the manger, but we had houses. How many had that kind of stuff at Christmas time? And the train that went around, I didn't even know what that had to do with anything. But there was all kinds of stuff going on, and a whole table was set up. You know, so when my mom and, well, my dad passed, but when my mom passed, you know, all those things were given out to the kids. And all I wanted was baby Jesus. So I got that. So the manger's empty. Who's ever got that in the family? But I'm good with it. Because I figured that, you know me, I steal things. So it's like, that's probably the most valuable. Baby Jesus, probably the most valuable. Anyhow. But one thing always stood out to me is why did the wise men come? What is that all about? What's that story? What does that have to do with anything? And why would they come and visit Jesus? Anybody ever ask that kind of question? Well, you're going to get an answer for it. Least you can do is leave here and amaze your friends with, hey, I know where the wise men are around. But this is something for us to take from here, is to realize, as believers or as people interested in the faith of Christians, it's good to know that our story has history and it's not a myth, that what happened took place in history. It's actually been written down, and it was written down way before it happened. And that gives us knowledge. It's the only book of all the faiths out there, all the different religions, that tells the story hundreds and hundreds of years, recorded, 66 books recorded by 40 authors over a 1,500-year period, that tell a story about things in the future that have yet to happen, but they've happened. And so when we look at the manger scene and we look at the wise men who are there, there's a story to that. There's a reason these people showed up. It isn't just statues we buy. And so, well, I'm going to share that story with you today so that you will know that our faith is founded on fact. And all through the Old Testament, we're told in Scripture that God gives a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, because the angels and the demonic also look into this, and so God gives pieces of the story, and sometimes the only way to put the pieces all together is to look after it happens and to look back, and then you see what took place to bring this to the present state. And it's the same thing in your life and in my life. A lot of times people don't want to ever look at their past. And they, you know, that happened and I never want to look at it again. And then they wonder, why do I do the things I do? Why do I act like this? As if it's something that you just woke up one day and said, I'm going to be dysfunctional in this way. Or I'm going to function well in this way. There's a history and a belief system that took us to that place. And if I can't look at where I came from, then I can't really look at how I act the way I act today. What caused me to do that? What caused those kinds of belief systems? And when something is revealed, then it can be healed. Well, in the case of God, he's revealed to us very, very much in the beginning of Scripture of what our problem was. How we fell away from God, how we got disconnected spiritually, disconnected in ourselves, disconnected from other people, disconnected from our environment. Scripture calls it a sin thing, falling short. And then he gives the remedy and says the final, the true remedy will take place. And even now, today in this present age, we're waiting for Jesus to come back to fully establish what we all want in our hearts, everything righteous, everything right, everything good, the new heaven and the new earth. He's going to fix it. But he came as a baby. And so tonight we're going to look at the story of the wise men. And to understand this, we have to go back 600 years before the birth of Jesus. It's told to us by a young man named Daniel, who was suffering under the bondage of the world government at the time called the Babylonians. And under this king called Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar's dad established the kingdom of Babylon. Babylon ruled the inhabited world. It was one of the great kingdoms. This guy built it up and then dies. And his son, Nebuchadnezzar, takes over in 606 BC. And he starts an immediate imperialistic expansion of the kingdom. He said, I want to make Babylon the greatest. And so he started to attack and take over countries. And then when he would take over a country, he would do something that was very unique and is still unique to this day in history. He would take what we would call royal hostages. He would take hostages. And those hostages would be members of the ruling government's family, would be members of the nobility, people who would know about the culture of the country he was taking over. And he would gather some of them and he would bring them into his country, feed them well. They would live in palaces. But they'd be under guard. And there were two reasons for that. The first reason is if anything went wrong with the country that they took over, and the main thing this guy wanted from them was taxes. You guys ever heard of taxes? It's when the government takes money. They wanted taxes. And so he said, if you pay me, I'll let you kind of live the way you guys want to. I'll let your culture be the way it is. But I'm going to take some of these hostages, and they're royal. You care about them. They're family members. And I will use them as leverage against you. If you don't, then the first ones to die are them. And there's a second reason he would do this. One, it enabled him to understand the culture that he was taking over, or the country he was taking over, how they lived, how they governed, how they viewed life. So he would learn from them what they did, including all the magic arts, astrologers, enchanters, people that would talk to the dead, people that would talk to spirits. Because in those days, the government and religion were united. They were not separate entities. It all flowed together. So if you had people in your nobility and you guys were super into arts, the dark arts, I'd want some of those people. I want to hear because I want all the help I can get. Then he would also, while getting that from them, he would have his people train those people in the ways of the Babylonians. That way he could use them to go back and tell their old country about Babylon and all the way they do it. So he would have a good handle on what's going on in those foreign countries and what was being his, spreading his propaganda about their country. Everybody following me? So, comes Israel's time to be invaded. And this is what happened. During the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign of Judah, so there was a king in Judah, it was during his third year of reign, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. He said, we're taking you over. You're going to have to pay taxes. And for a little while, Jehoiakim, the king of Jerusalem, said, we'll pay taxes, leave us alone. But at one point he said, nah, we don't want to pay you guys no more. And so like any good government, they come and take it. They come and get it. So in verse 3 it tells us this, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. So he took these people and brought them to Babylon. He said, oh, you're going to play a game with me? I got your people. Select, he says, only strong, healthy, and good-looking young men, he said. And make sure, I don't know why he chose the good-looking young men, but he did. And make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning. Make sure they know. They are high enough in their original government that they know what's happening in that country. They are in the know. They know everything behind the scenes. They know how it all operates. He says, make sure they're well-versed in every branch of learning, are gifted with knowledge and good judgment, and are suited to serve in the royal palace. They are the caliber of people that can serve as in my world. Then train these young men in the language and literature of Babylon. Now we're going to train them. The king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens, and they were to be trained for 3 years. They would undergo an apprenticeship of 3 years. And then they would enter the royal service. Daniel, you want to remember him, he's the guy that actually wrote this. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were four of the young men chosen, all from the tribe of Judah. So I told you how the system works. I told you what they were doing. And now Daniel narrows it down to him and three of his buddies. When the training period ordered by the king was completed in verse 18, the chief of staff brought all the young men to King Nebuchadnezzar. 3 years later, they've been being trained. They are brought in. You can read the whole story on your own, but I'm taking the highlights. The king talked with them, and no one impressed him as much as Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, El and Azariah. So they entered the royal service. They became part of his counseling team. Whenever the king consulted them in any matter requiring wisdom and balanced judgment, he found them 10 times more capable than any of the magicians, the enchanters in his entire kingdom. So they're in service to him now. They're being treated like royalty, and they are royalty, and now they are the counselors. And he calls in the counselors as he wants to give him advice on what to do or what to do in a particular country, what's going on. Then something happens. In Daniel 2:1, we're told one night during the second year of his reign, so he's 2 years into his reign, he starts this expansion, and in the second year, he has this gnarly dream. He says, Nebuchadnezzar had such a disturbing dream that he couldn't sleep, and he called in his magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers, and he demanded that they tell him what he had dreamed. As they stood before the king, he said, I have had a dream that deeply troubles me, and I must know what it means. So he called in the magicians. In our day and age, a magician is not a sleight of hand person back then. It was a psychic. It was somebody who could call on the spiritual realm and have the spirits give them information. They had it, he said, call in the enchanters. The enchanters are the ones that we would call a medium. They're the ones who talk to the dead. So you got certain group that practiced the art of talking to spirits. You had another group that talked and would have seance type stuff and talk to the dead. Then you would have the sorcerers, bring those guys in, and those are the ones that practice witchcraft. They have occult knowledge. They're the ones that can cast spells and curse your enemies. And they're the ones, voodoo dolls type stuff. They do witchcraft. They are into the occult dark. And then you would have the astrologers, the ones who would seek wisdom from the stars and see the way they would line up, and they would bring that. So he says to these guys, I want you to tell me my dream. If you read a little bit more in the story, he says, I've told you my dreams, and then you guys would interpret them. But I think you're kind of scammy. I think some of the info you give me is not good. So with this dream that's been really bothering me, tell me the dream. Tell me what I dreamt and then interpret it. So when he tells them that, that messes with them. And so their response to that is in verse 4. Then the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic, long live the king. Tell us the dream and we will tell you what it means. But the king said to the astrologers, I am serious about this. If you don't tell me what my dream was and what it means, you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be turned into heaps of rubble. But if you tell me what I dreamed and what the dream means, I will give you many wonderful gifts and honors. Just tell me the dream and what it means. So the astrologers replied to this and go, they replied to the king, no one on earth can tell the dream, the king his dream. And my king, however great and powerful, has ever asked such a thing of any magician, any enchanter, or any astrologer. He says, you're going against what we do. We like to hear the dream and then we'll tell you. The king's demand is impossible. No one except the gods can tell you your dream, and they do not live here among people. In other words, there's no way to find out, and we can't order the gods. The gods live far away from us, and we have no way to get to the gods. We can talk to some spirits, we can talk to the dead, but we can't get to those gods. They're very distant from us. So the king did this. The king was furious when he heard this. That's my name in scripture, Fury. So it's biblical. The king was furious when he heard this, and he ordered that all the wise men of Babylon be executed. He goes, you're all dead. I'm done. So he's obviously had issues with these guys. And because of the king's decree, men were sent to find and kill Daniel and his friends. He didn't call for Daniel in this particular dream. He called all his spiritual things, all his spirit guys. And because of the king's decree, men were sent to find and kill Daniel and his friends. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, so the head guard guy came with whatever amount of soldiers he was, and he was rounding up everybody that was a wise man, and they were all going to die. He was going to start from scratch. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, came to kill them, Daniel handled the situation with wisdom and discretion. In other words, he was calm, and he approached this guy and said, what's going on? He asked Arioch, why has the king issued such a harsh decree? So Arioch told him what had happened. Daniel went at once to see the king and requested more time to tell the king what the dream meant. He says, let me talk to the king. And Arioch says, okay, go. And he, for whatever reason, he found favor. You know, God will sometimes give us favor in the most desperate way. This guy's getting ready to die, and he spoke in such a way that it moved Arioch. A soft answer turns away wrath. You know, when we fight fire with fire, how many know that everybody gets burned? You know, so a soft answer really does work. So he did, and the king wanted to know. Daniel went to the king. went at once to see the king and requested more time to tell the king what the dream meant. Then Daniel went home and told his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah what had happened. So they get together, they pray, and they go, God, we're in trouble. Anybody ever inform God of what's really going on? That night, in verse 19, the secret was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven. Verse 23 said this. He says, I thank and praise you, God, of my ancestors, for you have given me wisdom and strength. You have told me what we asked of you and revealed to us what the king demanded. So that night, sleeps. Next morning, he goes in and says in verse 24, it says, and Daniel went to Arioch, the guard, whom the king had ordered to execute the wise men of Babylon. Daniel said to him, don't kill the wise men. Take me to the king and I will tell him the meaning of his dream. Arioch quickly took Daniel to the king and said, I have found one of the captives from Judah who will tell the king the meaning of his dream. The king said to Daniel, also known as Belteshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar not only would take your original name, he would also give you Babylonian names. And some of you might know Daniel was called Belteshazzar. Anybody ever heard of Meshach Abednego? Shadrach and Abednego, thank you. Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, the guys that get thrown into the furnace. Yeah, that's his buddies. Is this true, the king says? Can you tell me what was my dream and what my dream was and what it means? Daniel replied, there are no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or fortune tellers who can reveal the king's secret. But there is a God in heaven. There is a God that's connected who reveals secrets. And he has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the future. Now I will tell you your dream and the visions you saw as you lay on your bed. In your vision, your majesty, you saw standing before you a huge shining statue of a man. It was a frightening sight. And the head of the statue was made of fine gold. His chest and arms were silver. Its belly and thighs were bronze. Its legs were iron and its feet were a combination of iron and baked clay. And as you watched this man, a rock was cut from a mountain, but not by human hands. A god cut that rock out of a mountain. It struck the feet of iron and clay, smashing them to bits. And the whole statue was crushed into small pieces of iron, clay, bronze, silver, and gold. Then the wind blew them away without a trace, like chaff on a threshing floor. But the rock that knocked the statue down became a great mountain that covered the earth. It was more powerful. That was the dream. Now we will tell the king what it means. Your majesty, you are the greatest of kings. The God of heaven has given you sovereignty, power, strength, and honor. He has made you the ruler over all the inhabited world and has put even the wild animals and birds under your control. You are the head of gold. You know, this guy was such an amazing builder, and his dad too, that they built with all these canals the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, known as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, along with the pyramids and some other things. This thing was so magnificent that birds from all over would fly. Animals lived in these hanging gardens. It was over seven stories high. It was phenomenal. It covered massive amounts of area with all these gardens and all this stuff going on that people would come from everywhere in the inhabited world to view these gardens. And Daniel says, God has given you this. Your kingdom is like a head of gold. And then he goes on to tell him this. But after your kingdom comes to an end, so it's going to end, another kingdom inferior to yours will rise to take your place. And after that kingdom has fallen, yet a third kingdom, represented by bronze, will rise to rule the world. Following that kingdom, there will be a fourth one as strong as iron. That kingdom will smash and crush all previous empires, just as iron smashes and crashes everything to it strikes. The feet and toes you saw were a combination of iron and baked clay, showing that that kingdom will be divided. Like iron mixed with clay, it will have some strength and will be strength of iron, and some parts will be as strong as iron, other parts will be as weak as clay. They will crumble. What happened in this kingdom that would come is they intermarried as a way to rule. Every kingdom deals with other foreign nations in particular ways. And this fourth kingdom would deal with nations by intermarriage. And they would form alliances with other kings. That was their way to keep these other kingdoms under control. Except these marriages, which were forced on nobility, this person would have to marry that so we would be connected, caused great bitterness in families. Lots of times there was no love there. There was cruelty. They were doing it because they had to form alliances. And so this kingdom, though it was of iron and strong, its feet, its foundation was iron and clay. It was weak. And he says, goes on to say this. The mixture of iron and clay also shows that those kingdoms will try to strengthen themselves by forming alliances with each other through intermarriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron and clay do not mix. During the reign of those kings, during the reign of that time, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed or conquered. It will crash all those kingdoms into nothingness, and it will stand forever. The great God was showing the king what will happen in the future. The dream is true, and its meaning is certain. So let's take a look at these four kingdoms that were prophesied about. If we can get that statue up there. First kingdom, head of gold. We got two pictures. All right, let's go with this guy. The head of gold. Gold is the most valuable. Babylon was an amazing kingdom. It lasted from Nebuchadnezzar ruled there from 606 BC. And when you count BC, you go down because you get to AD at the end. They ruled from 606 BC to 538 BC. Then something happens. The Medes, a nation, and the Persians, a nation, joined forces, which took over in 538. That is represented by the two arms in the chest. Two arms of silver become united in one chest, and they overtook the Babylonians. This is history. This was written 500 years before any of that took place. He says, listen, well, not that, but the whole story, the whole scene. The Medes conquered the Persians, and they are considered by, in the dream, silver. Silver is inferior to gold, but it isn't inferior in strength, as these guys conquered the head of gold. What they were inferior in was the luxury, the creativity, all the things that the Babylonians did in the world of art and all that stuff, the Medes and the Persians didn't do. So it was inferior, but not in strength. But then we moved down, and they ruled for 207 years. In 331 BC, Alexander the Great came, and he conquered the Medes and the Persians, and they set up the kingdom of Greece. And that is represented by the bronze of the skirt and the belt. They gave us much philosophy, much bronze inferior to both, but they introduced bronze into warfare. Gold and silver didn't really have warfare. These guys introduced bronze. And so they ruled for 168 years. In 168 BC, the Romans came on the scene and attacked Greece and conquered them, and it became the beginning of the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire represented as iron. They were the first nation to use iron as a primary instrument of war. Yet their feet, by what I told you earlier, were partially iron, partially clay. So the kingdom did not stand. But the Romans lasted for 644 years until 476 AD. Long, long reign. And then they continued to live in a weaker way up until the 1400s, till they were finally destroyed and the Roman government came to an end. And it's interesting that the Roman government collapsed from inside. They were not conquered. They collapsed because the way they designed it, the way they ran their country. So, he said to them, during that kingdom, the Roman Empire, would come the king who would ultimately smash them. Because the scripture says at the end, there'll be a new heaven and earth. It will all be smashed and it will be righteous. He says, in that kingdom, during that time, between 168 BC and 476 AD, in that time period, the king would come from God. So, this is the dream, and this is what he had. When Nebuchadnezzar, going back to Daniel, hears that that is the dream, that's exactly what I saw, your interpretation is dead on, I resonate with it, it's what it is, he does something. It says, then King Nebuchadnezzar, verse 46 of chapter 2, threw himself down before Daniel and worshiped him and commanded his people to offer sacrifice and burnt sweet incense before them. The king said to Daniel, truly your God is the greatest of gods. All these other guys got gods. All these other guys got stuff. All my other counselors. But your God, he knows more than them. And that's why this king laid down before David. The kings don't do that. And he worshiped the true God. He says, your God is the greatest of gods, the Lord who is over kings, a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this secret. Then the king appointed Daniel to a high position and gave him many valuable gifts. He made Daniel ruler over the provinces of Babylon as the chief, and this is the important part, as well as the chief of all the wise men. At Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be in charge of all the affairs of the province of Babylon while Daniel remained in the king's court. He took Daniel and said, you now are in charge of all the enchanters, the magicians, everybody. You're the one to teach them. So from that time in 506 about, Daniel started to teach these guys the way of the Israelite gods, the way of Judah. He would tell them about Abraham. He'd tell them the story of Adam and Eve. He'd tell them how the Israelites were under the bondage of the Egyptians and how Moses did these 10 plagues. And he'd be teaching them the story, the history of what took place. And he'd also be teaching them this, that in that fourth kingdom, something happened during the time of Moses that you guys will know the exact time when the king would come. And he'd tell them the story of Balaam. Toward the end of the 40 years in the desert that the Israelites were in, they're getting ready now to go into the land of milk and honey. They're going into their country. And while they were getting ready to go, another king from another area asked a prophet named Balaam to curse the Israelites. Balaam was a wicked prophet, but God spoke to him. God would reveal things to Balaam, even though he was in it for money. God would reveal things to him and he would share. Well, one of the prophecies he gave was the fourth prophecy he would ever give. And he's looking and all of a sudden he sees something. And this is what he wrote down, or what Moses wrote down, of what happened. In Numbers 24:17, this wicked prophet said, hey, I see him. Now this is 1,000 years before Daniel. I see him. I see the one coming, that rock. I see it. But not here and now. I perceive him, but far in the distant future. A star will rise from Jacob and a scepter will emerge from Israel. He said, I will see a star and a scepter. So the enchanters, all these wise men, even though Babylon was conquered, there were still kings there. This information would be passed down generation after generation. It would go into their books of training the new counselors to the kings that would come generation after generation. And when it got to the Romans, these guys knew, uh-oh, it's in this kingdom. This is three kingdoms from Babylon. It's going to happen. And Daniel would have taught these guys that you need to be looking for a star. It will direct you. So there is historically a comet that came. Let's get that picture of a comet up there. A comet, they called it a star back in the day, but it's actually not. But it has a tail. A tail would be a scepter or rod of authority. All the kings, you know, when you see king pictures, when you go back in movies and stuff, they usually have some kind of staff that they use for their authority. They'll anoint people. They'll make judgments. He said a star will come and a scepter. It will have a staff. So about 1 BC or so, a comet showed up. And they saw it in the east. And they go, whoa, this thing would happen. Now at night, they would see it. Then day, the sun would come and black out the light or white out the light. They wouldn't be able to see it. So what would happen then is they would follow what they saw at night. And then during the day, they'd stop or keep going in the same direction. Now you got to remember, these are noble men. These are counselors. So this kingdom was going to make sure they were made peace with this God that was coming to earth. So they would follow it. It started in the east, and then during the night, they would travel and follow it, and then the sun would come up and they'd lose it. And then they'd keep going in the direction. Then the following day, the get dark, they'd see it again, and it was falling almost straight down. And it would take quite a while to make that move. If you've ever seen a comet, they don't just go zip. They take an arc and come down. So these guys would be following. We don't know how long that comet lasted. It could have been months, could have been longer. But once they saw that, they knew that this was the time of that king. So they would have gone into their king at the time and say, hey man, we see that it's happening. It's now. And so the astrologers would look at it. They would judge it. They would say, yeah. So they would get their entourage. These are noble men. These are not three guys. You know, there's a church tradition that says there was three kings. There might have been three. There might have been more. But bottom line is they would have a military escort. They would have all the supplies they needed would have been in carts. They'd have their slaves. They'd have the tents rolled up. They'd have all the food they would need. They would be protected, and they would start their journey following where that star was coming down, or in reality, a comet was coming down, and they would be moving towards that. Now, they didn't have all the information. And so one time when they started getting close to the area, the star, it becomes day. And so they go, well, what? They would say something like this. Well, we don't know exactly, because they didn't have the information about Bethlehem. God doesn't always give us all the information. He gives you enough to go on, but he doesn't give you all the information. He keeps everybody, keeps the believers in faith, and keeps the enemy off balance. So they would go to the king in Jerusalem. Oh, this guy would surely know. This guy would know where this king would be born. And that's where we pick up the story in Matthew chapter 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea during the time of King Herod, magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who is born King of the Jews?" Where's the king? You ought to know you're the king. You ought to know what's going on. "We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." Not just give him stuff, to worship him. They knew him as God. Now people, Herod was a wicked king. I'm not going to go into his story, but he was not a good guy. So King Herod, and he was super insecure. They said it would be better to be a dog in his house than a human, because he killed his kids. He killed his wife. He killed anybody that he believed threatened anything in his life. They were dead men and women. So he was a scary guy. So King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this. So they must have come seen him during the day and said, "We lost his star. Where is the king?" They got an audience with the king. Now remember, they're coming as a royalty. And then when the king was upset, everybody in Jerusalem was shaking. You ever been in a house where when dad's not right, everybody's on pins and needles? That was Jerusalem around this guy. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law and asked, hey. So during that day, he said, "Oh, let me find out what's going on." He gets the religious leader and he goes, where's the Messiah? Where's the king supposed to be born? Where's the Jewish king supposed to be born? And in Bethlehem in Judea, they said, for this is what the prophet Micah wrote, or the prophet wrote, "And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the cities of Judah." You know, it's always weird that God always chooses the least. It's weird. But it's also comforting, isn't it? "For a ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." So then Herod called for a private meeting that same day, most likely, with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. How long have you been following that star? When did it first appear that the king would be born? What's going on? He wanted to find out. Then he told them, "Hey, go to Bethlehem, that's where he's at, and search carefully for the child, and when you find him, come back and tell me, so that I can go and worship him too." After the interview, the wise men went their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. So they leave, they wait till night, and guess what? There's the star again. A few miles off of Jerusalem. Jerusalem and Bethlehem are about 6 miles apart. So they're leaving Jerusalem, and they go, "Oh, it's over here. It's in the east, over here." And so they start going, leads them right to Bethlehem, and then it's probably got lost over the horizon. The comet was gone. So once it hit Bethlehem, it was gone. And so they entered the house. Oh, wait a minute. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. They opened their treasure chest and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now imagine these royalty coming to a nothing house, a regular house, to see a king be born. No king is born in a regular house. That must have messed with them to think, this is where the king's being born. How many, anybody else ever get surprised by what the Lord does? This is the way it's rolling out. This is the good plan. So they're doing that. What'd they do? They saw Jesus on his mother's lap because he was a toddler. That word boy means actual toddler. So Joseph had been doing his business. They're making a home there. They're doing life. And then these guys show up with their support team, with their guard, with everything else. And they come and they bow down and they present him three things. Gold, which is metal, a metallic substance, symbolizes as the best thing, best gift you can give a king is gold. Especially in that day, that was the most precious thing you could give him. So you give him the best. You tell him, "We're good. We these guys acknowledge who you are. We don't want any trouble. We're all good here." Then they gave him frankincense, which is an incense, which is what you would burn before a god in many of the religions of the world, representing your prayers to the God. This God who answered dreams also can answer prayers. Whether he answers them, that's up to him. How he answers them, that's up to him. The length of time between the prayer and the answer, that's up to him. It's all up to him. But it represents prayer. The last one was myrrh. It's what you would embalm somebody with. It represents death. It represents something dying. I don't know how much they knew about this king, but they knew something would happen, would be tragic. And it's interesting that it's listed gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Myrrh is at the end, that there would be tragedy at some point. How much they knew, we don't know. But here's for us today. See, we're the priests today. And in your seats, there's a card. And this is where we can be. We can give Jesus a gift today. Everybody should have one of these. If you don't and you would like one, we can get you one. Is there a gift you should give to the king that's really valuable to you? What is your most valuable thing you can give to the king? Oh, you can give him your life. But some of us, it could be our time. Maybe we keep our time to ourselves. What is the gift you can give? So you can write that down here. And what we'll do at the end is allow you to come up and you can present it to the king. Maybe the second one too. Maybe you can add to that a prayer. Is there a prayer you've been praying? Is there something that has weighed you down prayer-wise in your life? Maybe it's a prayer that hasn't been answered yet. And you're recognizing today that this is what I want to give to the Lord. I want to give him this prayer and I'm going to leave it to the God who will answer. And then the third thing is maybe there's something that needs to die in your life. Maybe there's something God's been telling you, this thing needs to die in your life. Maybe it's fear. Maybe it's worry. Maybe you don't think his timing is all messed up. God, what is, you know, I'm going to trust you. Maybe it's an act, something you do that you're always fighting with. You know, as we're getting ready to enter 2024, maybe it's time to let something die that needs to die. Maybe it's your ego. Fear. Maybe a prayer needs to be purpose. God, what is my purpose? Why'd you put me in this generation? You put Daniel in his and... You know, the thing about Daniel, he lived as a hostage his whole life. He never left that. I'm sure he wanted to go back to his home country. I'm sure he wanted to go back to his place of war. Maybe God's taken you out of somewhere and you'll never be able to go back there. Is it still okay to honor God? Is it still okay to let him be the shot caller? So as you contemplate some of that stuff, after you write it down, present it to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. So we have these three boxes up here and you're free to come on up and to place it in the box. And this is what you need to do, man. Trust him. It always comes down to a trust factor. The God who tells us the story before it happens. He's got your story written out too. Your story is written out. And the Bible tells us it'll be a good story. It'll work out well. And then you can be free to leave after you're done and have a most blessed Christmas.